I'd like to bring to order the House Business and Labor Committee. We're going to, I know we carried over some people who didn't get to testify earlier, but we're going to start with House Bill 2971 as our original agenda had. So with that, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2971.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that chief sponsor is Representative Clem, and it is a measure that allows horse or dog race meet licensees to have up to 50 video lottery terminals. There's no amendment before you.
Thank you. So I'm going to have up Karsten Hinze and Mike Dewey. Good late afternoon.
Mr. Chairs, co-chairs, for the record, Mike Dewey representing Portland Meadows Racetrack, and I'll make some comments and have Karsten then finish, and he'll do much better than I will. Mike Rogers, who is with the Stronach Group, part of the ownership of Portland Meadows, left me a voicemail. He was going to fly in from Toronto, but his plane plans changed or whatever. So he's not here, but Karsten knows the issue extremely well, and so we'll have a twosome here. So we come here in support of House Bill 2971. It's a very simple bill. It would allow commercial racetracks up to 50 video lottery terminals. And your administrator talked about the horse track and the greyhound track, and there isn't a greyhound track in Oregon, but technically, if there was one, they would be allowed under this bill up to 50 machines, but there isn't. So it would only be applicable to Portland Meadows. In 2003, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 3159, which provided up to 10 video lottery terminals for Portland Meadows. Other establishments that have video lottery machines have up to 6 under the state statute. So there was a carve out for us. And in that legislation in 2003, there was a preamble. And I'm not going to read it, summarizing it very shortly. It basically said that it was in the best interest to increase lottery proceeds for the state of Oregon. So that is in part why that bill passed. Also, part of this equation is the situation involving a Native American tribe 16 miles from Portland, the Cowlitz tribe, that is going to be opening a full-blown casino in the state of Washington, again, about 16 miles on I-5 north of Portland. And just a couple days ago, the United States Supreme Court denied cert on the appeal of that decision to the Supreme Court. And by virtue of that decision to deny cert, in other words, not to hear the case, the litigation, all of that litigation is essentially over. Notwithstanding, they have built the casino. It's almost operational, but the litigation has been finished at this point in time. So that will adversely impact, there's no question, the revenues to the lottery and the casinos that operate here legally in the state of Oregon.
Call from 877-503-1674.
So anyway.
Yeah, if everybody could check their cell phones, make sure they're off. That would be, you know, kind of nice.
Mine is off.
I'm going to check mine, too.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Fortunately, I'm okay. So when we testified earlier, I guess it was last week, on the social gaming bill, the reason we're asking for the 50 machines or up to is we are a gambling facility. People do come to our facility to gamble. I mean, that's very clear. It's a racetrack. We have live racing. We have wagering on simulcasts. He'll talk about a wagering hub that we own and operate in Beaverton and what they do. We have the video lottery and we have poker. So we do have an establishment that is about gambling. Now, we do think some people come for the food. It's a pretty good deal, so if you come out, that would be something you might want to try. But that is the situation. So this would, and let me say, there is no question in our mind in terms of watching what happens at the in the racetrack and in between races and opportunities to wager on horse races, there are a tremendous number of people that are waiting to play the machines. So we think there is a significant demand for more machines at this particular facility. Stronach Group, which is out of Toronto, operates Portland Meadows, and they operate a number of other fine racing facilities throughout the United States. Let me say what we do is, with regard to this legislation and other legislation that has helped us over a period of time, is if this bill were to pass, we would have conversations with the host owners, the breeders, the quarter horse folks, the thoroughbred breeders, and the like, and the county fairs that have race meets. And we would be talking about increasing purses that helps everybody in this business, because horse racing is about 100 to 200 million economic activity in the state of Oregon. Now, I do want to bring up one issue that may come up, and that is in 1995, and I was involved in this legislation, a bill passed House Bill 3411. What that bill did is allowed up to, at commercial racetracks, up to 75 video lottery terminals. And the governor vetoed that bill based on the advice of the attorney general over the dominant use principle. Now, there's not a lot of precedent around what constitutes a casino. So we, Portland Meadows, through Senator Farioli, asked for an attorney general's opinion as to, in their opinion, whether or not 50 video lottery machines would constitute a casino. And we also provided, which was lacking in the AG's opinion, were the facts around the revenues from horse racing, video lottery, simulcasting, the restaurant, and the like, and the size of the building, taking into consideration the building and what we do as an industry. And it's very clear when you take it, when you take horse racing and the revenues out of the mix, they would not, in and of itself, constitute a casino. So even though the precedent is pretty slim in terms of this being litigated, legislative counsel said, in our opinion, although it's uncertain, 50 machines would not constitute a casino. One way that we can find out is having this bill pass, because there may be some litigation over that. But the only way that we can find out is to have litigation, because otherwise there's no standing if a bill doesn't pass. So I'll stop there, answer questions at the appropriate time, and ask Karsten to talk a little bit about the operation and the company. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Olvey and representative members of the committee. My name is Karsten Hensa. I'm the vice president of the Stronach Group and also the general manager of Portland Meadows. Portland Meadows has been in District 22 in North Portland since 1946, operating as a horse racetrack. I'm here, as Mike said, to speak in support of HB 2971. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of context. Mike hit a lot of the points, so I'll just give you a little bit extra flavor for why that's important to us and why we think it's worthwhile for Oregon and Oregonians. As Mike said, we consider ourselves a place to gamble, and we're proudly that. We are unashamed of it, and we think it's the right place to do that. Our founder, Frank Stronach, operates six, and his company operates six racetracks around the country, some of the premier racetracks, Santa Anita in Los Angeles, Gulfstream Park in Miami, and the Maryland Jockey Club, where we run the Preakness, the second jewel of the Triple Crown. We also have many racing-related companies that do work in the industry and that handle or the money that's bet through the U.S. industry. I mean, we're a significant share of that. We have sizable, so that's to say we have sizable investments in the U.S. racing industry, and we also have sizable investments in Oregon racing. So ExpressBet is one of our advanced deposit wagering company, and we have in Beaverton an operations center that has 75 people employed. Portland Meadows that I run has over 100 people employed, $2.5 million worth of wages roughly, and part-time, full-time, that type of thing. Just to give you a sense of the scale, Portland Meadows is different than those other racetracks that I mentioned. Mike likes to call it, they're the major leagues, and we're probably the double A or triple A team. So we have our unique challenges, just like a team in a sort of second tier league. So we're scratching and clawing for everything to make our product viable. So we're looking at all options all the time, and this is part of that effort to try and bolster Portland Meadows, and then a really big part of it is the industry as well. And a lot of people don't know how the racing industry works, so I'm going to take 2 minutes of your time to explain roughly how I would go through it with people. Racing is its own ecosystem. We're the front stage where we put on the show and people come to bet and have the fun time. But the backstage work that's done on farms and everywhere else is a lot bigger than what we put on. As Mike said, the economic impact to the state, the activity through the state is $100 to $200 million last time we went and looked. And so it does beg the question, but why should we care? And why should anyone care about this legislation? And the money would get recirculated through the process through purses, which is what the owners of racehorses run for. The reach also extends to breeders and to the professional support people. There's like trainers, veterinarians, farriers. There are farms throughout the state that raise and train these horses, contributing to sustainable green space activity. There are farmers that grow feed and hay. There's also an army of grooms and support people that work with horses every day. They're on our backside. When we're open with live racing, we have 16 barns full of horses and people to take care of them, caretakers. This industry creates agricultural jobs, professional jobs, and service jobs. Many of these jobs are hands-on trades that allow people with fewer academic qualifications to be gainfully employed. I have a letter here, but the industry group, OHBPA, represents 800 horsemen and horsewomen. And I also have support. We have support for this cause from the quarter horse people, as Mike had mentioned. We like to say that we have typically have 9 people touch a horse before it gets into the starting gate. So there's a lot of other activity going on around where that this bill would contribute to. As Mike mentioned, the fairs as well. It's not a stretch to say that a strong commercial race meet, people own horses, so they want to own horses to have an opportunity to run their horses in competition. We have 5 rural fairs that I would say are hinged on the commercial race meet at Portland Meadows. So the support of this would help bolster that part of the industry as well. Just close by saying that there's the other parts. Oregon Racing Commission is a net contributor to the general fund, as well as the advanced deposit wagering companies. So that's to say that, all to say, that Portland Meadows is a kind of a linchpin for the industry in Oregon. It's where people want to go race their horses, and keeping it viable and healthy is sort of my main goal. Increasing the number of VLTs would certainly do that. The revenue, because of the sharing agreements, the revenue share to the lottery is significant, and we get a small slice of that pie, but we think it would be a very valuable pie for us, piece of the pie for us. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I might, if I may, Mr. Chair, just add one more comment. And one of the nice things about the Internet is having the opportunity to see other folks that might testify and what was posted on OLIS. Part of the testimony was, well, this is going to benefit a Canadian company. Strana Group is a Canadian company, but they have, as we have noted, substantial interest in racing interest and other commercial interests in the United States. That's where the bulk of the business is. So it will benefit the employees here and also across the country with regard to the investments that we can make in other places. So I just wanted to add that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what constitutes the limit in gambling in Oregon? I mean, obviously, if you already have 10 machines, you know, you're already gambling. And you mentioned the Constitution and whether this be constitutional or not. So is it the amount of dollars that goes through the machine? Is it the amount of dollars that people win? What constitutes the boundaries there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not the expert on this. Ecumenical Ministries case is the predominant case with regard to how we define what a casino is. But we have a prohibition when the voters, through initiative, enacted the lottery. I think the language is the state cannot constitute a casino. And so there can't be a private casino in the state of Oregon. So the issue is, you know, what does that look like? How do you define that? And it's over a dominant or predominant use. And so that was the discussion that the AG had. It wasn't a very long opinion, but it did get the bill vetoed, I think, as I said, 1995. But what we added to the context, if we're talking about dominant use, what are the revenues from racing? Because the racing side of the equation isn't part, in our opinion, as to what would constitute a casino. So when you talk about dominant use, you would probably talk about the size of the facility and also talk about revenues and where the revenues come from. But we don't really have enough legal precedent here to know exactly whether or not this would constitute a casino, and it would ultimately, I think, get to the U.S. Supreme or the Oregon Supreme Court. That's why we asked for the Legislative Council, and we tried to, if you will, provide some facts as to, you know, what are the revenues, how much are they, and what's the square footage of the building, and it's pretty big. So I can't answer it the way you'd want because it's open. That's why I said the only way we can really find out is to pass a bill.
Good. Thank you.
So along those same lines, just ask a question. So you mentioned you had a hub, and so under this bill, would the hub also get 50 terminals if this bill were to pass?
No, it's limited to the physical location of the Class A licensee, I believe is the language. So it's the physical location. There's, it limits it. It's limited for sure.
Yeah.
So this would be limited to the geographical location of Portland Meadows in Northeast Portland.
Because I understand there's also hubs for Greyhound Racing around too, so they wouldn't qualify under this bill.
No.
For extra
and
large.
Those are just for some background. Those are they're basically data centers and call centers is what they are. And we were the first state to pass a law to regulate the hubs. And so literally all the worldwide wagering goes through, these are all in Beaverton, goes through data centers in Beaverton, but they would not qualify by any means for this legislation.
So a hypothetical question, you know, I think under testimony under the poker room bill, you said if we shut down poker rooms across this state, that Portland Meadows would go out of business, or you would shut your doors or something to that effect, you know, and I'm trying to think of poker rooms as being social gaming and how, you know, how that social gaming would cause you to shut down one. And the hypothetical question along with that is, you know, if poker rooms were to be considered gambling in this state and therefore not allowed, would these 50 lottery machines help you keep your doors open? Or would they? Or would you still shut down?
So I hope I didn't represent that we would shut down if that happened with the poker bills. We would shut the room down, or we'd have a discussion, or we'd have to look at what the new rules
are. Oh, you were just talking about shutting the poker room down, not Portland Meadows. Okay.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah, under that legislation, because we are a for-profit, it wouldn't work for any company like ours to operate the facility as a nonprofit. It just doesn't work in terms of how you set up the companies. So by no means, I mean, what we said is we'll work under, like the city of Portland, we're going to work under the rules because there is a demand for that. But no, this, we're not shutting. There are other indications of, as to whether or not this racetrack continues.
So when you talk about that predominant use, is it the predominant use of just one aspect of your facility? Like when I look at, you know, so you have horse racing, mm-hmm. wagering on those horse races. You've got video lottery machines. You've got a poker room and... You know, if you add all those together, they sound like they'd be pretty close to a predominant use of gambling.
Yeah, the way I look at it is the predominant use is the wagering on horse races. The VLTs that with the 10 that we have now, and even an expansion of that, as well as the poker room, would not.
But you don't aggregate all those gambling things?
I don't think we actually did when we submitted our information for the opinion. We just used our horse racing-related revenues. At the time, I'm sure I didn't know what some of these other areas were doing, what the poker room was doing, for example. The VLTs, I don't think they probably were included in there, but they're I won't say dwarfed, but mm-hmm. our predominant use is wagering on horse races.
The revenues are significantly higher than they are from the VLTs, even under a 50 scenario. And we might, and this is a business decision, we might phase those in over a period of time just to see how it works and find out where the elasticity is in that. But I don't see them starting with 50, and we'd have to negotiate with the Lottery Commission also in terms of how they would want to go about doing that.
Okay. Other questions? Thanks for being here after hours.
Yeah, thank you.
After hours, isn't that a gambling show?
Probably.
Up next, I'd like to have Jeff Marotta? Brent Mack. I'm going to say Brent Maxson. I don't know if that's right. I can't read the... And Wes Wood.
My husband.
And why don't David Ellsburn go ahead and come up and drag an extra chair up if we can. Thank you, Kayla. If you just introduce yourself for the record, that would be great.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Marotta. I am a problem gambling expert and consultant. One of my clients is a Voice of Problem Gambling Recovery. The individuals sitting at this table represent their board members, or some of them. They asked me to look into this bill, and what I did as a researcher, I looked into, is there any precedence here? And as you heard, there is. And what I positioned you is that we're looking at a bill that has gone through a process back in 1995, very similar to this bill. The only difference was one was adding upping the limit to 75 as opposed to 50. It did receive an Attorney General's opinion, as you heard. The governor decided to veto that bill based on that opinion. And I just want to read to you some of that opinion. In 1995, a similar measure was proposed. It was House Bill 3411. The general attorney's opinion on this bill stated, there's a high probability that a court, if presented with the question, would hold that HB 3411 violates Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution due to the concentration of operation of 75 video lottery terminals that would be permitted in a single racing facility. And then in a separate opinion, again from the Attorney General's office, in reaching this conclusion, Attorney General Kolongoski relied in part on the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in Ecumenical Ministries. He noted that the Oregon Supreme Court had concluded in their decision that in adoption subsection 4, the voters intended to prohibit the operation of establishments whose dominant use or dominant purpose or both is for gambling. And you heard earlier that that the predominant use or, you know, whether or not, how would we define that? And if the way to do that is to bring it to the courts for that decision, I would argue that would be a waste of the energy of the court and of public funds to support that court action, because it would be hard to say that an establishment that is all about wagering with either video lottery terminals, card rooms, and pari-mutuel wagering is not a gambling establishment. It sure looks and sounds like a casino to me, and I think if the court was given that prerogative to make a judgment whether or not we're talking about an establishment whose predominant use is gambling, I don't know how they would say it wasn't. So I put to you that moving this bill forward would frankly be a waste of public funds to test whether or not, if in fact we're looking at a predominant gambling establishment or not. That's all I'm going to. I to me, that's where the argument ends. But I'm going to let these folks tell you a little bit more about other concerns about this proposal.
Chair Holby, Vice Chairs, Committee, thank you for your time, late time today. My name's Wes Wood. I am the Director of Voice of Problem Gambling Recovery, and we are an Oregon-based 501c3, and we've been serving Oregon since 2007. Our mission is to advocate and to educate and to promote recovery. My personal story involves 2 years in treatment, 2005 till 2007, prepaid here in Oregon. What I want you to appreciate about the conversation is that what we know is in Oregon there's over 80,000 people right now that need problem gambling services. We currently treat about 1,500 a year. We also know that to consolidate services, the key for play is location and time and money. We also know that historically, events such as we've gone through on Hayden Island with Casino Row, it's been difficult at best. It's been more like chaos to those that live out there. It attracts crime and other issues related to those types of problems. We know that casino play is a part of Oregon. We know that lottery is a part of Oregon. That's the choice of the voters. We're not really debating that. What I want you to be aware of is that, as Dr. Murata so succinctly stated, you know, this has already been visited. We don't need to visit it again. You know, what we know at our level is the highway between Spirit Mountain and Portland has the highest suicide rate. We know that compulsive gamblers have the highest successful suicide rate of all the addictions. I would question you around what part that wants to be for us in Oregon. I think I'll just stop with that. I'll pass that. Thank you.
Testing 1, 2. Excuse me. I'm Brent Maxson. I'm a fourth generation Oregonian. My grandparents, they made their homestead on the Oregon coast, were Salishan. And my grandfather had the Sweats Boat Works and built the Oregon Webfoot. It was at the World's Fair in San Francisco. And I am a former video lottery retailer, and frankly got addicted to playing the machines. Thank you. So it created an economic hellhole for my family. So in my opinion, this bill to expand these video lottery machines is an economic development, but takes money away from the economy where folks would buy shoes for their kids and take their folks and feed their family. We have the lowest high school graduation rate in the country. And, you know, a lot of people that are living on the edge are buying these machines that we have. They can't make their house payment, their rent, and they're living out of the car with their kids. And, you know, so I think this idea of expanding this horse race organization to 50 machines, it opens the door to how about bowling alleys doing the same thing, you know. All they need to do is have fire lobbyists and put some money behind them, and where does it end? So you have to draw the line somewhere. You know, let them have their 10. Everyone else has 6. And I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is David Ellsburn. I'm also a member of Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery. And I joined Voices because I'm very in tune to the pain that problem gamblers go through. In my family, it's cost my family roughly $270,000. So it's very painful, but I'm not here to talk about my family. I want to give you a little bit of history. As has been said, the Oregon Constitution prohibits casinos. So an interesting thing happened say around a decade ago is that the legislature told the lottery that they could put VLTs in. So they can put 6 here and 6 there. And after a while, some business people figured out that they could make a lot of money from these machines. And so there are, you know, the Denny's and the Elmer's and all that, they're legitimate businesses. But there are some vendors of Oregon lottery products who make 90 to 100% of their profit off these machines. If they sell any food, it's a loss leader. So I consider these mini casinos in violation of the Oregon Constitution. And I'm evidently not the only one who thinks that way, because there's a Secretary of State audit here written in August of 2015, and the title is Oregon State Lottery, Unclear Laws May Let Prohibited Casinos Operate in Oregon. But that's not the axe I want to grind today. I want to talk about this bill in front of us, which benefits Portland Meadows specifically. Portland Meadows has 160 machines plus. And so this is a de facto lottery. This is a de facto casino in my mind. Now, Portland Meadows will tell you that these are not class 3 slot machines. These are pari-mutuel machines. They're based upon horse racing. So that kind of confused me, because I've seen pictures of these. This one's a Lucky 7 machine. It's kind of like a very old slot machine. And here's one, very cherry. You line up the 3 cherries and you win. And this one, Nordic Fortune, it's a little bit more modern, but still, it looks exactly like a slot machine to me. So I was confused. I had to go down there. Most people in my organization can't go down there, because if they went in there, they'd be in danger of relapsing and maybe a multi-$1,000 relapse. But I'm relatively immune to that. So I went down there and I looked at the machines. And they do indeed have a little screen at the bottom about the size of a cell phone. So when you push the spin button, you see the horses starting to race on this little screen. And if you're patient enough, you'll see 6 horse races for every spin. But that's not what I saw when I observed people playing it. Every single person there was pushing the button, pushing the button, pushing the button. They weren't using them as pari-mutuel machines. They were using them as slot machines. And that pushing the button, I'm not saying that the people there were problem gamblers, but that's a very typical behavior of the problem gambler. They'll push the button, push the button, push the button, see the lights flash. It'll start the dopamine going in their brains, and they can self-medicate that way until they run out of money. So that's what I saw over there. But that's also not the axe I want to grind. What's done is done. I don't think we should add to that by putting more machines there and turn it into like a 200-plus machine casino. So I think the people of Oregon in 2012, they said, we don't want to change the Constitution. We don't want to have private casinos. I don't think we need to add to that. I don't think we need to sidestep the Constitution and add more machines. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Questions? Thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you for your time.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2971. And we will open a... I need that list of bills. We'll open a public hearing, which may seem a little bit expansive, but this is what it is. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3043, on House Bill 3045, House Bill 3093, House Bill 3157, House Bill 3246. Jan, you don't have to give us a description of all the bills, but remind us what the major issue here we are talking about.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the major issue is looking at transportation network companies. There are various bills to regulate them through either DCBS or ODOT. Questions about background checks of the drivers who are engaged with these transportation networks, and questions about insurance. And I think that hits the main pieces. I would like to note, though, on OLIS, we do have amendments to House Bill 3246. We had received amendments from Representative Leininger and Representative Clem and Representative Susan McLean.
Mm-hmm. All right. I see we do have an agency person signed up. So in light of that, I invite her up, Amy Joyce. Don't know what your schedule is for this evening, so...
Chair Holvey and, pardon me, and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Thank you, Chair. My schedule this evening is to be here with you, so thank you. I'm here testifying among those bills on most of them, 3043, 3093, 3157, and now also 3246, because 3246, with some of the amendments that showed up on OLIS, would involve ODOT as well. And then the base bills on those other three have some version of ODOT involvement in regulating either the TNCs or the taxis. Just kind of broadly about all of these bills and amendments, it creates a new regulatory scheme, and there's really little or no background in our agency for the oversight of these groups. There are many elements in some of these bills, and some of them are rather unclear as to what the direction would be for the agency. For example, under House Bill 3043, the TNCs would conduct a myriad different checks, traffic tickets, criminal convictions, related or unrelated to driving, whether they're listed on a particular sex offender website. And then the bill says that ODOT may use the information and may assess civil penalties if it found the transportation network company didn't follow the law. But permissive under the bill really means that we'll have to prop up a new regulatory program to perform this function. House Bill 3093 would have ODOT creating standards for conducting and interpreting drug tests. Under the bill, the TNC would conduct those tests when it intends to engage the driver, which by my reading would be something like when it employed or brought on a driver initially, and then says that ODOT can assess civil penalties for each violation, and appears to mean that they need to be tested every time they're going to offer up their services, so every time they're going to drive. So it's unclear whether that's a one-time pre-engagement drug test or every time they drive. And again, ODOT has no experience or expertise in the realm of drug testing. House Bill 3157 would repeal and preempt local jurisdictions' ability to regulate taxis and like vehicles. It would regulate the entry into the business, require permits, control rate calculations, control rate maximums, regulate routes, set safety standards, equipment standards, insurance standards. Once again, this is outside of ODOT's core business and competencies. To implement these bills, if we were given this task, we, again, need to stand up a new regulatory unit. We're unclear whether that would be perhaps under the DMV or under our motor carrier division, the trucking regulation section. But just in general, things like overseeing criminal background checks, overseeing sex offender status checks, establishing standards for drug tests, setting taxi routes and rates statewide from Lakeview to LeGrand to Portland. None of this is within our normal purview, so we'd be asked to do something in which we have no expertise. And I would echo Representative McLean's comments from the other day that putting this control at the state level may not be the most efficient from a state agency standpoint. And finally, my comment for those not well-versed in the transportation sector, almost all of ODOT's funds are the highway funds, state highway funds, which are constitutionally dedicated. And our reading of this is none of this activity would be highway fund eligible, so the program would have to be either self-supporting or other funds would have to be identified for ODOT to run a program like this. And that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Quick question, Representative Hurd.
More of a statement. So, Ms. Joyce, so thank you for always taking care of me when I call you like a helpless child for assistance.
It's Chair great Holby to put a face to the name. So. It's my pleasure. Always happy to take care of constituent issues.
She's not shocked by the helpless child part, by the way.
Yes. So does ODOT have any standards for...
She is great.
I guess drivers for hire to move people around, i.e. taxis or any other. Are there any sort of requirements at all through ODOT?
Chair Holvey, at the state level, there's no oversight of taxis, no regulation of that sort of thing.
So they just have to be licensed with a license plate and registered, I would assume.
Correct. At the state level, Chair Holvey, for the DMV, you have to have a driver license and have a license plate on your plate. I even checked with DMV to see if there are particular special license plates for taxis or limos. No, they're considered passenger vehicles. Unless you get up over 26,000 pounds, then you're a heavy vehicle, but that's a different situation.
So just a standard driver's license, you can drive taxis?
Chair Holvey, that's correct.
Okay, and you don't, and there's no designation for that at all?
Chair Holvey, no.
Okay. Well, I guess you don't have any expertise in that field.
None. Thank you.
So, all right. No other questions. Thank you for being here. All right. Well, I have a list of people who were signed up that did not get to testify. And so I'm going to start with Delilah Jones, Brian Roberts, and Grant Ewell. Do they happen to be here?
Brian Roberts and Grant Ewell are not here.
Okay. How about Steve Entler? Eileen Brown? Charles McGee? No. Evening's getting shorter.
So we get to ask more questions.
Why don't you go ahead and give us your name and your testimony, please.
My name is Delilah Jones, and I'm a driver with and a shareholder with Radio Cab in Portland for the last 9 years. I'd like to thank Chair Holvey and the rest of this committee for giving me the opportunity to speak today, and also, and more importantly, for your thoughtful consideration of these far-reaching and important issues. I would like to state first off that I oppose House Bill 3246 for two reasons. Specifically, number one, it defines transportation network companies as completely different than taxis, and I think that's just absolutely untrue. We provide the same service regardless of how the ride is arranged, and therefore the regulations should reflect that. Equitable regulations are important to help ensure public safety and civic responsibility within our industry. Secondly, by making a statewide regulation, you would be overriding controls which have been the prerogative of local jurisdictions for over 100 years, as well as taking revenue from local government agencies, as the representative from the Eugene Airport spoke to on Monday. And this should not be done lightly. I'm really glad to hear the ODOT representative speak on that. It shouldn't be done lightly or at the request of an out-of-state corporation. We need to proceed cautiously in such a delicate matter and important matter. So with this in mind, I would like to examine the other House bills that are before you today, House Bills 3043, 3045, 3093, and 3157. Taken in aggregate, I see that these four bills provide all of the positive benefits from House Bill 3246 without any of the negative consequences. The only amendments that I would suggest would be to make the criminal background and driving record checks required in 3043 to be required annually. As you well know, the more you drive, the more chances there are to be issues. As a new taxi driver, 9 years ago, I had a perfect driving record, and in my first year, I got I got one ticket, which, makes sense. But some of these drivers who might be picking up Uber passengers and Lyft passengers may have never driven much before, and so I think an initial background check and driving record check is not sufficient, and in fact it should be annual. As an owner-operator at Radio Cab, these requirements are hoops that I easily and gladly jump through every year. To me, they represent a contract with the members of my community, giving assurance that I will continue to provide safe rides in perpetuity. In addition, none of the bills speak to vehicle checks, vehicle inspections, which is something that I do every 6 months. So that's just something to keep in mind. So in summation, I'd just like to say that public safety is my number one concern, and I'm certain that it's yours as well. House Bills 3043 and 3093, which is the one that speaks to drug testing, represent to me a minimum bar for drivers who would like to be trusted to transport the public in Oregon. I'm confident that you'll act in the best interests of the people of Oregon and not those of the out-of-state corporations. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Chair Olvey, members of the committee. My name is Steve Entler. I'm the general manager at Radio Cab. I've been affiliated with a cab company for 47 years now, I believe it is. And I'm here to oppose House Bill 3246 and support 3045. And I would also like to mention a little something about House Bill 3043. Among my other duties, I'm also a foster parent. And as a foster parent, we're required to undergo a fingerprint background check. And, you know, it sounds a little invasive, so to speak, but, a fingerprint background check is not like it used to be. So much of it is done on what they call live scan. It's an electronic device. They're all over the state, probably 50 to 100 different stations, and it takes about 10 minutes to have it done. And the fingerprints are instantly sent to OSP and FBI, and they start their background check at that point. And you get the results back fairly quickly. It's cheap, it's easy, it's not that big a deal. And it's certainly one way of showing who it is that's driving our citizens around, not just depending on some internet background check. House Bill 3246 contains a number of issues that I don't agree with. First of all, one of the ones that I noticed right off was the reduction in the age limit for driving to 19. I don't know about you, but I remember how I drove when I was 19. I don't think I would have been capable of carrying people around. If something's changed a lot since then, I'd like to know what it is. Also, I wonder how a 7-year background check works when you're only 19 years old. The elimination of local municipal oversight and regulations are other things that also bother me. But the one that I've really been hammering on for years now has been the insurance scheme that is being used by the TNCs. You'll hear a lot of different things about it. And in its basis, they identify three different driving periods. Period one, where I believe is the one where the driver logs onto their app, but they have not been coupled with a ride yet. And then period two, I think, is when they actually they've got matched to a passenger and they're going to get them. It's usually not that far. And the third period is when the passenger is in the car. Now, they have divided those things up, at least in Portland, so that periods two, or the two periods when they're actively engaged in transporting the passenger, the TNC company insurance is considered primary and provides $1 million worth of coverage. But as soon as that customer is out of the car and the driver's on his own again, but still logged on the app, the limits of coverage, both by the company and by the driver's own personal insurance, are drastically reduced. So think about that when you step off the curb and you get run over by one. Be sure and look inside of the car to make sure there's a passenger in it, because if it is, your life is worth $1 million. If it's not, it's only worth $50,000. Not sure how well that plays with your heirs, but that's kind of the way it works. So somehow or another, they've decided that your life and your medical conditions are worth a lot less only because the passenger is not in the car. Now, they consider, the TNCs will tell you that their insurance is primary. I don't know how they define the word, but in the real world, that's not the way it works. We as Radio Cab have been involved in approximately 14, 15 accidents with them at this time. All but one of them was their fault, and all but one of them showed the driver's personal auto insurance on the scene of the accident. From what I understand, they're instructed to do that. And by doing that, they're not really in the primary position anymore. Oftentimes, at least with other people, they don't know any better. You know, Radio Cab, we actually know it's a TNC vehicle, will pursue the TNC insurance company. But Joe Blow Public, they just think, oh, gee, my Toyota got hit by your Honda, and I'll submit my insurance information to my company, and hopefully I'll get my fender fixed. The companies avoid a lot of the exposure that we are subjected to. Now,
Representative Evans, did you have a question?
I do, Chair, and thank you. So I understand. Sometimes I need things broken out of smaller pieces.
No.
When you say 14 or 15 accidents with them,
yes,
is that Uber?
Uber and Lyft, or both. A lot of times they're carrying both.
So when you say 14 or 15, you don't have it broken down as far as whether it was more with the company that is already admitted to trying to fool the city versus not.
I'm not sure
Uber.
What you're... Oh, it really doesn't matter. It's more the driver. The companies, first of all, the companies do not require their drivers to inform their insurance companies. They require, the TNC company requires their drivers to have personal auto insurance, but they do not require them to inform their insurance company. As a matter of fact, it's almost discouraged that they let their insurance company know. It's like, you're going to provide what we consider primary insurance, and your insurance company really doesn't have any knowledge that you're even affiliated with a TNC company. So, you know, there's something basically wrong there.
Thank you.
I happen to know that there is what they call rideshare endorsements available for some of the insurance companies now, but I still don't hear a lot about anybody actually allowing their insurance company the knowledge that they're affiliated with a company. Now, Radio Cab and a lot of the other companies in Portland and throughout the state pay a lot of money for liability insurance, and there's good reason for it. I mean, we get in a lot of accidents. We're subjected to a lot of exposure. And now the TNCs are doing functionally exactly the same thing as a cap. They're subjected to the same kind of exposure that we are, the same kind of risk. But their personal auto insurance is not reflecting that. We pay $8,000 to $10,000 a year to protect the other people, just liability only. You got to ask yourself, what's the difference between a cab where a driver is engaged in a in an activity with a commercial vehicle that uses it sometimes for personal use, and as the TNCs call it, a personal auto that's used for part-time commercial use? Where do you draw the line? When does it become, when does a personal vehicle become a commercial vehicle? A lot of these guys are putting in 40, 50, 60, 80 hours a week in their personal auto. I doubt that any of you are driving your own vehicles that much. So the functional things that that bother me the most, of course.
Well, and if if you could, you know,
I was going to summarize.
Yeah, try to bring it to a conclusion for us so we can get to some other folks. It would be great.
First of all, I think it's a, should be a definite requirement that a TNC driver obtains some kind of a rideshare endorsement, notifying their own insurance carrier that they are affiliated with a transportation network company, and they are using that vehicle that they have insured for commercial usage. That's just common sense. They also should be required at the scene of an accident to show the company insurance, not their own personal insurance. Uber and Lyft should not have the ability to look at the accident after the fact, if it actually hits their desk, and say, well, decide whether they want to take responsibility for it or not. It should be primary. That should happen. And the other thing is that there should be equal levels of coverage for all periods of activity under that transportation network company. Your life, your children's life, the pedestrian's life, whatever, should not be worth less only because there's no passenger in a car.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any other questions? Appreciate you being here tonight.
Thanks.
Up next, I have Art Towers. What's your name? Go ahead and come up. And I was just going down the list as I have them in sign-up order. And Dan Mark, why don't you go ahead and come up as well?
Mr. Mark's not here tonight.
Okay. How about Dirk Warningoff?
Not here tonight.
Jesse Smith?
I'm not here tonight.
Mark Weider? Mark Weider? Not here. Jeanette Tybert? All right, go ahead, Sean, and introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Chihalvi and members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Sean Johansson. I am a Salem resident. I have lived here for 7 years, raised my whole life in Oregon. I am a IT contractor for the National Energy Technology Lab in Albany. That's my full-time job. I started driving for Lyft and doing rideshare about a year ago after my vehicle was involved in a stationary accident where it was parked and was damaged, and I was left responsible for some costly repairs. My wife and I had some discussion as to how we're going to go about paying for them. We do our best to avoid debt, yet as most Americans had quite a lot of it. We chose, knowing that it would raise my insurance rates significantly, to have my insurance take care of it. And at the time, Lyft was offering a new rider bonus for sign-on if you completed, at that time, 60 rides within 30 days. We decided I would take that on as a weekend job versus picking up a scheduled part-time job in order to pay for the car. What began as just a means to an end for me to get the repairs my vehicle desperately needed became the means for me now being zero credit card debt on all four cars that my family holds. In the year of driving, I have paid off all credit card debt that I have. My wife is actually unable to work due to medical conditions, and so I'm the sole income earner of the family. And even being in the IT field, I was not able to even break even. This opportunity has, even driving from Salem to Portland, usually 3 days a week, I spend my weekends in Portland, driving has changed all of that. Now that we're debt-free, my wife and I, after 8 years of marriage, are finally considering moving into a house instead of an apartment, either renting or buying, and we have the opportunity to start a family, whereas we were going backwards financially every month. In addition to that, my vehicles are now completely paid off, and it's created the excess income where I was able to invest in a new minivan, 2014 used, of course. But it's allowed me to start taking larger capacity rides with Lyft, and it's paying for itself. And in addition, will be paid off on average in about a year and a half instead of a five-year loan, while providing the extra income my family needs to be able to move into a larger place. I know several other personal, friends of mine and acquaintances here in the Salem market who are interested in driving and have even signed up, but because of their situations aren't able to make the trip to Portland like I am. They can't spend all weekend because they already have children. While doing these drives many times, I have picked up passengers even at the Portland airport and had to drive them outside of the pickup window for Portland markets, putting me equivalently unemployed for 20 minutes while I had to drive back into town, unable to pick up a ride because I had left the authorized zone. Because you are, as permitted, allowed to pick someone up and take them anywhere. But once you leave that zone, your app is useless. So halting my income and making it so I'm now not able to work until I drive back up into Portland. Whereas if I'm within the Portland market, be it even out as far as, Beaverton or Gresham, I can pick someone up and take them back where I'm heading or anywhere they want to go. I really am in support of House Bill, I believe it was 3246, because it does expand that and allow drivers like me the opportunity to work anywhere in the state and not just if you're within proximity or have the time to make it to Portland and not be paid for that. I chose to start driving in Portland and still do because it allows me to take care of my family, and I'd like to see that opportunity expanded to more residents of Oregon. For my friends out in Sheridan, a small town with almost no cab coverage, all the way into here locally to Salem and down in Eugene. And I just would like to strongly encourage you to move that bill forward and expand that opportunity for more drivers who don't have the two-hour commute to spare because they have children and can't just leave all weekend like I do. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm curious, how are you paid? How do you actually get payment? Are you paid as an employee, an independent contractor? How do you receive your money?
I am very happily paid as an independent contractor. I am I file a 1099 on my taxes and am responsible for paying my own taxes on my income. I track my expenses following what my accountant has told me to do, and that has made things significantly easier having the support and knowledge behind me. I'm very comfortable being a 1099, and I wouldn't do it any other way because it gives me the freedom that when I have time, I can drive. And on weekends like this where I have to leave town for personal matters, I don't have to worry about getting time off or requesting it or notifying anyone. I just don't drive. Mm-hmm. It's direct deposit into my account every week. With the totals, and there's no real question. It's fantastic.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead. Whoever wants to go next.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'll also be testifying in place of Elizabeth Inayoshi, who was here yesterday or Monday to testify. She's has more expertise than I do in these areas, has an interesting perspective as both an attorney for workers as well as for small business owners as well. But she has provided written comments that should be on OLIS. So first I wanted to speak with concerns about House Bill 3045 having to do with insurance issues. As you know, our members are very concerned about this and making sure that there's consumer protection and also auto safety. And we feel that 3045 falls short on one important front in terms of, or a couple important fronts, in terms of making sure that consumers are protected at the playing field's level, and that those who do wrong and hurt people are held accountable. On page 3, on section 5 of House Bill 3045, participating drivers are required to provide coverage if the transportation network company's insurance policy is lapsed or is deficient. The reverse should hold true as well, so that in the situations that were described earlier, where a driver has not notified their company, for example, that they have, or their insurance company, that they are driving in this set of circumstances, if there's any sort of problem there, the TNC's policy should kick in as well. And that was a gap in the wording that we spotted. We also want to make sure that the legislative intent enacting 3045 is to make sure that the requirements for TNCs and taxi cabs are identical. We feel that that would be a fairer, the fairest way to go, or analogous at least. So this could be a step forward for Oregon consumers, but those changes are desperately needed. So then I want to move to the issues raised in House Bill 3246, which we oppose pretty strongly. We feel that the legislation as it's written benefits the transportation network companies at the expense of their drivers. We feel that we're setting precedents here with the gig economy around transportation network companies that could impact workers in other areas. Section 7 of the bill specifically chooses to define the drivers in these transportation network companies as independent contractors, despite the reality that these drivers are, in the vast majority of cases, simply doing a job, not running a business. Section 7 defines the drivers as independent contractors primarily on the basis of drivers being able to do the work on a flexible schedule and work for other companies. On that basis, and primarily on that basis, the law forces a driver who make work 20 or 30 or 40 hours a week for a single service to pay their own employment taxes, to have no unemployment insurance, to have no workers' comp coverage, to have no Oregon sick leave protection, no overtime, no minimum wage guarantee. And that job may be part-time, it may be the worker's choice to work part-time, as we heard earlier on, but still a job, and that worker's still an employee. The key tool of the industry is the software that allows the driver to be alerted to rides. The company owns and controls the software. Without access to that software, the driver can't work. The TNC driver can indeed decide when he or she is on duty, but beyond that, the driver has little control over the rides. The driver, the transportation network companies control which drivers can see the requests, and so they can spread the work over available drivers, making decisions about work that way. Finally, having two jobs in and of itself does not make a worker an independent contractor, and the lack of a non-compete clause does not magically make an employee into an independent contractor. And so for those reasons, among others, we would oppose the legislation as drafted and urge you to consider this not just in the context of transportation network companies, but also in the context of the changing gig economy coming at us. I'll stop right there and be happy to either answer or duck any questions you might have.
Why don't you go ahead and provide us your testimony? Thank you.
Chair, representatives, thank you for this time. Thank you for your dedication to this. I can't imagine sitting in your seat.
We were forced into it.
I got it. My name's Jeanette Thiebert. I'm a proud Oregonian, born here. I'll live most of my life in Western Washington County, Clackamas County, Salem, and Portland pretty much sums it. I've had the privilege for the last 14 years to drive a taxi cab. 10 of those years were what they call a wave vehicle. It's a behemoth, almost as big as a bread truck, but I could take every one of my neighbors. Well, not everyone. No matter my neighbor's ability to walk, use a walker, a wheelchair, or electric wheelchair, or an extended wheelchair where they couldn't fold their 6-foot body up into a seated position, my taxi cab would take them safely. Okay. I'm here because Oregon is a fabulous place. It is the home of Oswald West, of Tom McCall, of Abigail Scott Duniway, and you. Let me connect a couple dots, if I may. House Bills 3043, 3045, and 3093. The fingerprint, the insurance, and the pre-employment drug screen. Okay? What do they have to do? The common link is every one of those bills is about the people of Oregon. It's about caring. And this is what I'm going to ask you. I'm asking you to have the same passion and care for the Oregonians who live here, for the people who work here, the people that come and visit. These bills are about the people, and they cost something to implement. Sometimes just a little, sometimes, you know, they protect the writers, they protect pedestrians on the street, the people that knowingly that drive, they're taking activity, the passengers engaging in an activity. The pedestrian has no idea about that car, but is still at risk. And all three of them are protected by these. Okay? We do things differently here in Oregon sometimes. From the bottle bill to the fact that a corporation cannot buy a square inch of our Oregon beach. You can live right up next to it, but you cannot purchase and own the beach. We've done things and chosen to do things a little different. We are willing to inconvenience ourselves for the greater good of our communities to protect those who live here, work here, and visit. And I'm asking you to do the same, to care as much today. So I say, Oregon, the home of Oswald West, Tom McCall, Abigail Scott Duniway, who believed that not only should men be able to participate, but women got to too. And I'm going to say, not only my able-bodied self should be protected, but my friends who are low income, my friends who are in wheelchairs, my friends who are over 70, 80 may not have the use of technology the way the 6-year-olds and 12-year-olds in my family do, okay? I'm asking that you show that compassion in how you regulate and write legislation that covers each of us. There is no, as the driver, one of the drivers who was at more of the subcommittee hearings of the for-hire task force in Portland, I saw a couple things that were really concerning in that. Not only were the cab companies and the drivers not able to have a seat at the table whatsoever, but there was one person on the task force who verbally derided the two representatives who were there to represent people who are marginalized and the disability community, to the point where the representative of the disability community resigned her position. They were verbally bullied and chastised. And then one day, the same gentleman who was the head of the head of and the Technology Association of Oregon stood up and he exclaimed very adamantly, "You people, you need to understand that from here on out, if you're going to do business here, you're going to have to provide data." If I hadn't been recording that meeting, I wouldn't have believed it. And when the transportation network companies fought over whether or not they needed fire extinguishers in cars, whether they provided the same level of insurance that I was already paying without complaint, I was required to provide $500,000 insurance, and I gladly provided $1 million. Because I felt it was in the best interest of my customers and my neighbors and my friends, without argument. So the rules were changed, and now I was required to provide $1 million worth of insurance. But oh no, they didn't want to do this. The TNCs fought this tooth and nail, but they did not want to provide the same level that they required me to provide. Just one of many little issues that they fought. They're now asking to write their own bill of goods. They're asking to write their own regulations. They could simply have abided by the existing regulations and freely done business in Portland, and they chose not to. No one has to live here. We get to live here. No one has to do business in this state. We get to do business. And with that comes responsibility. Thank you for helping cab companies, right, have better requirements. We want to improve. These three bills, fingerprint, insurance, and background and pre-screen drug, will help us regulate our own industry to do better. Thank you. We are trying to improve our own industry as opposed to saying we're above this. We're asking for your assistance to help us raise the bar. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know.
Just Representative Barreto, question.
Yeah, I've just heard several times, Arthur, are they a contractor or are they an employee? And I just wanted to know if Uber and Lyft have been around for a while. Has that been challenged in the results?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, I don't know the correct answer to that. I would imagine if I looked at my phone, I'd have 17 people texting me the correct answer. I will find out for you.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this evening. Appreciate it. Is Hayes Witt in the room? No. Kasri Hikanti? Owen Christofferson? And Matt Sayer? Carol Heacock, Pete Lim, would ever like to go first, please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Kasri Hikanti. I've lived in Oregon since 1987. I appreciate the chance to speak to you today. And explain why I oppose HB 3246. Since graduating from U of O in 91, I've had several different kinds of jobs and training. I've been self-employed as a consultant for many years. 2 years ago, when my consulting income began to decrease, I decided to drive for Lyft and Uber since it fit nicely into my schedule. Initially, the rates set and fees set were reasonable. Taxis were about 70% more expensive, so riders had no complaints about the cost. But soon after, the city upgraded the TNC status from provisional to permanent, Uber announced that they were cutting rates temporarily by 30%. I depend on the income I make from driving, and it was a huge unexpected pay cut. After mileage deductions, expenses, I don't actually make any taxable income. There is no profit. I'm just trading the depreciation of my car for a cash at the end of the week. These temporary cuts have never been changed, and TNCs still pay less than pay the 30% less than they did 2 years ago. I was so outraged when this happened that I helped found a group called the Drivers Collective PDX. The group, we're working to address the problems with the TNCs at the city level, work that will not be possible if this bill passes. Besides the lack of rate regulation, the other serious problem is the gaps and conflicts with how auto insurance works for TNC drivers. And you've heard tonight about this already from the radio cab person who spoke about that. I'm truly baffled that TNC rates are completely unregulated. Taxi rates have always been set by the city to protect both drivers from being underpaid and riders from being overcharged. When Uber arrived, instead of setting a minimum and a maximum within which they could operate, instead, taxi rates in Portland were deregulated. Why? Were they deregulated just so Uber could be unregulated? Portland taxi rates have increased a little, while the TNC rates have gone down that 30%. So now the difference between the cost of an Uber and a taxi ride is more than double. The Portland rate history details are online at thedriverscollectivepdx.com. I believe that each Oregon community should set their own rates and have the freedom to customize rules that fit their specific location and market. I believe that giving Uber this unchecked power statewide is outrageous and should be illegal. Thank you for your attention and time, and please vote no on HB 3246.
Thank you. Please give us your testimony if you want.
Good evening, Chair.
Otherwise, I'll call somebody else.
If you must.
Members of the committee, my name is Owen Christofferson. I live in Northeast Portland, and I've been a TNC driver for about a year and a half. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you about my experience as a driver in this industry. I'm a full-time student, Portland State, and to have the ability to completely scale the amount of work that I work in a particular week is a really great benefit to me as a student. I cannot tell you how many times I've heard from other people saying that they wish they'd had this job in college. In January 2016, driver pay, like Kazri said, was cut 25% per mile and 33% per minute. What had started as a great way of balancing school and work became more driving for less money. And throughout this whole time, other drivers and I work every day with the fear of getting deactivated for a reason we have no control over, or having our savings decimated by an accident. And I've talked a lot about the insurance issues. Despite our status as independent contractors, we do not have control over the rates we drive for. And indeed, we're not even privy to the news of rate cuts or other measures affecting our earnings until they happen. While some may not like having a boss, myself and other drivers struggle with not even having a manager or any single person who can listen to our concerns as drivers and take them seriously. Indeed, Oregon's own Bureau of Labor and Industry has issued an opinion stating that TNC drivers are employees and therefore deserve their respective benefits, protections, and representation. I urge you all to vote no on this bill in its current iteration. House Bill 3246 would leave drivers all across the state.
Yes, sir.
Please continue.
Sure.
Just wait a minute.
House Bill 3246 would leave drivers all across the state vulnerable to low earnings, inadequate insurance protections, and no employee labor protections whatsoever. The bill would also preempt any local regulation an Oregon municipality could enact regarding their own TNC market. There are several ideas which could be amended to this bill that would make the TNC industry fairer for all by recognizing the employee status of drivers and publicizing the TNC company's data to better improve our own public planning framework. I urge the committee to vote no on House Bill 3246, which would not make the TNC industry fair or equitable. It's time the state stand with drivers, like myself and others, who have suffered through low pay, inadequate insurance protections, especially when you don't have a passenger in our vehicle, and a lack of worker representation in any way, shape, or form. We have the opportunity here to take a stand for all Oregonians, drivers, riders, and community members. Thank you.
Representative Evans.
Thank you. I was going to wait to ask until you said it was okay. I promise. Thank you, Chair. So which company did or do you work with?
I work with both Uber and Lyft.
Do you work with both?
Yes.
It's most drivers do.
Quite a common thing.
Yeah. Other questions? See any? Go ahead.
Hello, everyone. My name is Pete Lim. I am currently a Lyft and a Uber driver. I started towards the end of January 2016, which is kind of interesting because the pay cut didn't actually start until, I believe, 3 months, 2 to 3 months when I was in there. Unfortunately, I didn't. It didn't concern me much because I didn't know how much people were making before and people were making now. Anyways, when I started back in 2016, I was a loan officer with Bank of America. I had about a two-year-old, and I had one more coming in July. And that time, I already knew my company was going to start moving or relocation or something was happening was the idea I was getting from the meetings we were having. So one day when I was in the break room, I was scanning through Facebook and saw an ad for Lyft to make $1,000 a week to start driving. So that's how I started, as a kind of just a part-time driver on the side. Since then, I've also drove for Uber. My company did move to Arizona and North Carolina. I was a loan officer at the Hillsboro location. And since they moved, I've been driving full time. Again, I have two kids now and a wife that stays at home. And the income that I get from Uber and Lyft right now is what's helping me sustain and support my family. Also, when I started driving, I didn't know a lot about the city, to be honest with you. I've lived in Oregon for 25 years, but the amount of area that I explored in Oregon was very limited to my day-to-day activity. I didn't like to drive to far places to go eat or anything like that, so I didn't get a chance to explore. But with this job, I was able to not only learn about everything, I found new dates, places to take my wife to, new opportunities, how to get a babysitter just from talking to customers. But again, like I said, the main reason I drive for Lyft and Uber is because it's flexible for me. I take care of my kids on Monday and Tuesday, give my wife a break because she'll go insane if I don't. And then majority of the other days I drive either about 30 to 45 hours, just depending on how I feel. I met some pretty interesting people driving for Lyft and Uber. One was this old elder lady in Lake Oswego. She was a part of the Lake Oswego elder community, and she had told me how much Lyft and Uber has changed her life, changed her ability to get to places, and how she was gonna put a presentation for people to help set up Uber and Lyft for elder communities of Lake Oswego so that way they're able to operate. She also told me about during the snowstorm, which we had an unusual amount of snowstorm this year, that she was able to get around surprisingly through Uber and Lyft, even though she's contacted three other taxi company that wouldn't come out her way to pick her up. And she needed to get to a doctor's appointment to make sure she stayed in good health. When I heard about that, I volunteered to see if she wanted someone that can answer questions. So she took me up on it, and we opened up at the Lyft at Lake Oswego elder community some questions and answer about the benefits of Lyft, how safe it was, what kind of screening it goes through. Kind of made a crack that basically, we get, screened, we get, background, the checks, but as passengers, you guys don't have to go through any type of screening or any type of background checks. So we don't know who we're picking up. So it is a riskier market, but there's also I introduced her to what's called the Lyft Concierge, which will allow elderly community, and Lake Oswego is actually going to sign up on it, which will allow them to request rides for the elderly if they need to get to appointments, if they need to get to places, and it's a free service for them because the Lake Oswego is going to pay for it. But I've also taken, people all the way up to Salem, all the way out here for, I had a couple of trips. The first one was this girl that missed a train, so she decided to order a Uber all the way out here just to make sure, to make her family reunion. Obviously, she didn't have a ride back, so her family had to take her back, or she would have to hop the train to get back. But I also have a friend who lives outside.
Just for a minute, I know you could probably talk to us about all the people that you've given rides to, probably till midnight.
No, you're
so,
fine.
But I'm really kind of interested in these bills, really.
Okay.
So I appreciate your experience with Lyft, but
The one thing I was going to add is my friend who lives outside of the Portland metro area. Every time that we go drinking together, has to drive into town to request a ride before we can, and when he goes back home, he can always request a ride back home, but then he has to figure out a way to get his car back every time he got it. And this bill would allow him to be able to request a ride where he's at. That's all I wanted to add.
All right. Thank you for your testimony tonight. I've got a few more people left to call up. Terry Stevens. Sean Miller. Is Jay Marinick. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record, please. Whoever's starting.
My name's Terry Stevens. I'm a Lyft driver. And I've been driving for him for about 18 months. Yeah, I'm an independent contractor. I was a contractor in construction for 40 years, so I've done this almost all my adult life, and this is the way I do it. I mean, the harder you work, the more you get paid, or you can just do other things. You have your own life. I live in Woodburn, so I have to drive up to Portland before I can start working. I've had a number of friends that live in Salem, or if I'm wearing my shirt and I've come to Salem, people say, "Hey, Lyft, are you in Salem now?" I said, "No. We're not here yet, but hopefully we'll get some laws passed so we can be here." But I get people asking me all the time about if Lyft is going to be available in Woodburn or Salem or, places outside of Portland. I could talk about all kinds of my passengers and everything, but it is such a good deal. Everybody that gets in my car is like, "Thank you for picking us up. Thank you, thank you, thank you." And Lyft is so great, and this and that. I mean, it's everybody really loves this, Lyft service. So, in conclusion, I respectfully ask for your support on a statewide law and make Oregon available to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Property Insurance Association and Casualty Insurance Association. And I want to talk to you real briefly just about the insurance requirements and our support for House Bill 3246, specifically Section 8 in the bill. starts on page six, but there's a dash five amendment, which we needed some clarification language. And I do need to reserve the right that we need to review this because I just reviewed it, and we may have to have some changes. But the idea is to reflect and represent a national agreement that all the major insurance associations and companies around the country and the TNCs negotiated an agreement in 2015, which has been adopted in most of the states around the country, including all the West Coast states that surround Oregon. And so, and I want to just talk briefly what that requirement is. And if on OLIS, you'll see I've submitted a little circle here, understanding TNC insurance coverage. And this is basically what I'll talk about. You've heard the three periods that were referenced. Period one is when you're waiting for a match. And so, you know, again, this is your personal automobile. And the whole idea of this agreement was to clear up the confusion when your personal auto insurance is in use, and when you literally switch over to where you are working. And again, I know there's been a lot of conversations. The whole idea of this, and prior to 2015, we were fighting with the TNCs. We had disagreements on this and on this, and this is why we came up with this agreement, so we can have some clear guidelines. And that's why the need for the legislation. That's why when we worked with the City of Portland, they adopted this. So there was clear guidelines of when your personal auto insurance is in use and when you're working. And so again, that period one is when you're waiting for a match. So again, you could be driving around town, you could be doing your grocery shopping. You can turn the app on, and at that period you are working, and so you're under this particular insurance requirement. And again, that's a 50,000 bodily injury per person, 100 bodily injury per accident, and then 25,000 of your property. And again, this is a minimum requirement. And when you heard discussions about primary, this particular requirement, the TNC is always primary unless the driver wants to have their own insurance, because there's other options, there's other products available. This legislation allows for that flexibility. And again, this is a minimum. This minimum in period one is higher than the minimum required under state law under your personal insurance. So it is a higher requirement. But again, you can purchase more insurance if you choose to. Just like on your personal auto, if you have a nicer car and you want more coverage, you're normally not covering the minimum. But again, we're trying to make this affordable and actuarially, you know, doable. And this is what the insurance companies did when we looked at this. And so, again, that's period one. Period two, the match made, that's when the $1 million coverage comes in. Period three, the million. Now, in all these cases, and again, UIM, the underinsured motorist coverage, which is required under state law, underinsured motorist coverage, and then personal injury protection coverage. That's PIP coverage, which in some states is not required, like Washington. Here it is required. That would be required under this, just like it is on your auto coverage. And so we were adamant, again, on protecting the drivers, the passengers, and a no-fault situation where, you know, again, these coverages are at fault, but a PIP coverage, and I know Representative Holvey's worked on these issues, that's a no-fault situation. Those coverages apply in all three of these phases, so that's important. I think we support the innovation in this industry, and I just wanted to real briefly go over why this is important. Again, this, I think, you know, the City of Portland adopted this. I think it's important to adopt it statewide, the insurance portion of this, because insurance is regulated by the insurance division on a statewide basis. And so, having different coverages in different jurisdictions just doesn't make any sense when it involves insurance coverage. That's why we think this is important to clarify this session. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude my testimony. Thank you.
All right. So, Sean, on these policies, is it the driver that's responsible for having the insurance policy in all three of those periods?
Mr. Chair, No, under this requirement, the TNC is required to have the coverage for the driver. Again, minimum of what you see here in these three phases for that driver. And again, they can choose to, and again, this is products that are available that could be a rider on your own insurance policy. If they choose to do that and have higher coverage or different coverage, again, it has to be higher than this minimum, then they can choose to do so. But that bright line, again, and how we see it, would be if they choose to have their own coverage, then that's the primary coverage. They can't show somebody their personal auto policy. In that case, which I've heard those examples, the TNC is always responsible under this in the city of Portland and they would be the primary coverage. And so, it is the TNC's requirement to provide that for those drivers.
In all three periods?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Jay Marinick. I'm a resident of Eugene. I'm involved in the taxi industry in Eugene, and I have been for the past 9 years. One of the hot-button topics regarding the regulation of TNCs, both statewide and nationwide, has been background checks. Representatives of Uber and Lyft sat here on Monday, Bryce Bennett for Uber and Lauren Bisesto for Lyft, and told you that their background checks are adequate, even better than the industry standard. I'm here to tell you that that's simply not true. I urge you to research a report that came out in the Boston Globe and other media outlets in Massachusetts today. Just to give you some context on that article, the new Massachusetts law regulating the companies required drivers to undergo a two-part background check. One from companies, meaning the TNCs, and then another check by the state government. Previously, the drivers were only checked by the companies. And what they did was they grandfathered so that the drivers could continue to operate, the drivers they were currently operating in with a deadline of April 3rd, that they had to get their state background checks in by April 3rd. Well, those results were released today, and as a result, 8,206 current Uber and Lyft drivers are not allowed to operate in the state of Massachusetts. Their licenses have been denied. That represents 11.6% of Uber and Lyft's current driver base in the state of Massachusetts. Again, this is all very new. It just came out today. The reasons for the rejections range from suspended licenses, not having been a licensed driver long enough, drunk driving, reckless driving, and violent or sexual offenses. To clarify, these 8,206 individuals all passed Uber or Lyft's background check process, but were rejected by the state of Massachusetts because of their newly implemented background check process. No doubt, this is the same background check process that the Uber and Lyft representatives explained to you on Monday. People with violent crimes, sex crimes, DUII, suspended license, were all approved by the TNCs and would have continued to transport the people in the state of Massachusetts were it not for this progressive law. We support fingerprint-based background checks administered by the municipalities. As evidenced by the Boston Globe article today, it's the only way to ensure that the driver's background is clear and that they are who they say they are. I would echo Representative Doherty's question on Monday, why are you opposed to fingerprint-based background checks? Why are you opposed? And I think the answer came out today in the state of Massachusetts. The second thing I'd like to touch on, sort of another hot-button topic when it comes to the TNCs, is automobile liability insurance limits. As has been discussed, the bill is written with a three-phase automobile insurance policy. The first stage is while a participating driver is connected to a digital network and available to receive a request for a prearranged ride, but is not engaged in a ride. The limits during that period are $50,000 for death or bodily injury and $100,000 max for death or bodily injury. I can tell you from experience that those limits aren't high enough. Unfortunately, the company I work for has a number of claims right now that are open that were would have happened in this phase one and are exceeding $100,000 in limits. So this would create sort of a gap in coverage for people where they injured during that time. As a matter of fact, we pulled historical loss run data, and the majority of our claims happened when somebody wasn't in the vehicle. So we feel that those limits are too low, they're not adequate, and they provide sort of a gap in coverage that endangers the public, quite frankly. One other thing that I'd like to bring up, sort of just a thought that I had when looking at the bill, is the bill reads that Uber or Lyft, that the personal insurance is primary and that they would kick in. What happens, as the drivers testified today, when they're on both platforms, but they don't have a fare for either? Whose insurance? I think you're going to get some finger pointing from each company's insurance as to who's going to cover that. I think that's something that the bill would need to address. I think that'd be prudent. So to summarize, we're not opposed to regulation of the TNC industry. We are, however, opposed to regulation that compromises the safety of the citizens of Oregon, which is precisely what passage of House Bill 3246 would do. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question. Okay, well, you have time for one question. Go ahead.
Well, it goes to the point. It's like I get the fingerprint thing. I mean, I do. And but why and what's going on if people are having more accidents on the way to pick up somebody than when they do or after? That seems like not great odds.
7-year-old company.
Sure. Representative Evans.
Or you can get me offline. You get the answer offline. It just seems awkward.
I'll be quick. Just from my experience, drivers tend to drive better, quite frankly, when there's a fare in the vehicle. They drive more safely.
Well, they can't pretend that there's somebody in the vehicle beforehand?
I mean, well, and just based off the nature of the business, it's just a huge percentage of the time they're empty. I mean, that's just how it is in our market. I can't speak to every market, but a large percentage of the time, they're empty more often than they have a fare in the vehicle.
Okay.
All right. Two more people left. Darren Campbell's, I'm going to give you another shot, and Michael Dale.
And they have 10 minutes.
And, yes, 5 minutes between the, well, anyway. Go ahead and get started. Thanks. I'm getting hungry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
angry.
Darren Campbell.
Angry.
Lobbyist for radio, if you have. I wanted to come back up and touch on a couple things. We did draft amendments for 3043, and today, this afternoon, we met with Amy Joyce, Representative Stark, and we had a captain from Oregon State Police on the phone, and we made the decision to put in a change of amendments to shift the responsibility for the fingerprinting and the all that to OSP from ODOT to improve that bill. The first amendments were not done as effectively as they could have been. So OSP, with the vast number of fingerprinting they already do, they said that they would have a rush of information or a rush of business at the start, but would be able to handle that. Secondly, 3045, we also have amendments coming. They're in editing right now in regards to limits and having the TNCs be primary, as well as having the same limits across the board. So those are going to be coming as well. I just wanted to make sure we touched on those. We have not spoken very much about the pre-employment drug screening. Right now, if an Uber and a Lyft and a taxi cab all got into an accident in the same corner, the only one that would have been drug tested is the tow truck driver coming to respond to the scene. Right now, we're going into festival time in Oregon, and with festivals come porta potties, and with porta potties come trucks that come and suck human excrement out of those porta potties. Those truck drivers are drug tested. Private hire drug drivers are not. So the individual that's driving around our human excrement is required to get a drug test. It doesn't make sense. We need these policies put in place to make our citizens safer. And it's not just safety for our citizens, it's safety for the drivers as well. So with that, I will let you go. I just wanted to touch on those two buildings.
Thanks for the update.
Chair Holby, Michael Dale from the Northwest Workers Justice Project. I'll try to be very brief. It's I understand how late it is and that I'm the last witness, so I'll try to do that. I would like to address 3 points, and they run throughout the bill, some of them, so I'll just, rather than identifying them particularly to a bill. First has to do with local versus state regulation. While establishing state regulation as a minimum statewide makes sense, the first 12 years I lived in Oregon, I lived in Ontario. Now I live in Hillsboro. What would be good regulation for Ontario would probably be inadequate for Hillsboro. What would be good for Hillsboro would likely be over-regulation in Ontario. And preserving the flexibility of local governments to set local conditions, it seems to me, is something that should remain, though we support the idea of minimum statewide standards. So that was the first point. Second point has to do with criminal background checks. Obviously, there are people whose criminal records are such that they should not be, that the Oregon public should not be exposed to them, as it's just too much of a risk. However, the elimination for crimes in these bills is extremely broad. And there is a competing consideration I'd like to raise with you, and that is that when people have done their time and have paid their debt to society, they need to find a place to work, and they need to be able to earn a gainful living. And more, because criminals are bad people and it's easy to say, let's exclude them from this market, what we're doing is eliminating opportunities for people to go straight and earn a good living in a legal and productive way. And so I would suggest to you that rather than just sort of as a category, say 7 years for a felony and this for that or whatever, that this be something delegated to the agency that's giving ultimate authority here as rulemaking authority, with some direction to say there ought to be attention given to proper safety of the public, but at the same time some attention given to whether the nature of the crime, when it occurred, is something that's really relevant and likely to present a risk to the public. So that's my second point. Third point. I won't belabor this because I can easily get way down in the weeds here, but one of the things that we do a lot at the Northwest Workers Justice Project is to try to figure out whether someone's an employee or an independent contract, because it comes up a lot for our clients. The tests for those matters have been developed in case law over 80 years. They're fairly sophisticated and fairly well tailored to figuring out who should be responsible for what. They are much, much more nuanced than the simple test here that says everybody's an independent contract or an independent contractor. The problem with being an independent contractor is you don't have any right to the minimum wage, you don't have any right to Social Security, you don't have any right to workers' compensation, you don't have the right to bargain with Uber or Lyft when they decide to cut your wage rate, because actually, if you're an independent contractor, you'd be violating the Antitrust Act to get together as a group and try to bargain collectively with those organizations. So I would really strongly oppose, I think it's Section 7 of the One Act that talks about independent contractor versus employee. In answer to the question that came up earlier to Arthur Tower, there is an Oregon determination by the Commissioner of Labor that Uber drivers are employees, not independent contractors. There are a variety of decisions around the country, but the thing is, everything goes on the facts and circumstances of the particular employment relationship, and so you can't very easily say that people are all one thing or another. So,
all right. Thank you for making it easy for us, and I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate everybody
Thank
that
you.
Showed up tonight to weigh in on this issue. Appreciate it all. Appreciate the committee members who stayed late and got some more information about TNCs. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3043, House Bill 3045, House Bill 3093, House Bill 3157, House Bill 3246. And we will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.